Well, good morning. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about using radioisotopes not to trace minerals coming across the landscape, but once you've determined the zone of provenance, figure out about how much erosion has occurred within that zone. I'm Scott Van Pelt. I'm with the USDA ARS Wind Erosion and Water Conservation Research Unit. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Mike Ketterer with Northern Arizona University, the Department of Chemistry. He's the fellow that analyzes plutonium for me. And next, Jerry Ritchie. Many of you know Jerry. Jerry was a great colleague, collaborator, and friend who has graduated and slipped the surly bounds of this earth, and he will be greatly missed. Well, wind erosion is a soil degrading process that results when wind strikes the unprotected surface of soil and shear stresses actually start soil particles moving. Now, this affects millions of hectares globally, and it's the primary source of atmospheric dust. Fine soil particles are mixed high into the atmosphere where they can be transported tens or hundreds of miles with the prevailing winds. Now, when we take a look at soil moving in the area very near the surface of the ground, the coarse particles with the very low surface area to volume ratios tend to stay very near the surface, oftentimes in the lower 10 to 20 centimeters, whereas the finer particles that have the higher surface area to volume ratios are lifted higher into the air. So we see enrichment ratios, which is the concentration of a particular chemical species on particles collected at that height divided by that of the soil surface from which they were generated, generally rise fairly rapidly above the surface. So let's consider now, if we know that wind erosion is transporting a larger portion of chemical species away from the soil, then is there a way that we can use these nutrients and trace elements to determine how much erosion has occurred at a site? Well, we're going to need to have certain characteristics for this chemical species. Among them, it should have been distributed fairly evenly across the landscape. So it really can't be associated with the parent lithology. It should not be biologically active. It should not be taken up by plants and enter the food chain where it can be transported by living organisms. And finally, it would be really handy if this chemical species appeared at a distinct point in history so that we have a starting point from which we can measure. Well, guess what? Chemical species have been created for some of us in our lifetime. And cesium-137 was the first of the anthropogenic tracers to be used for soil work. And it's a nearly ideal chemical species for this sort of work because it did not exist prior to 1945. It's not a part of the biological cycle. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, which doesn't seem just real long, but compared to many of the radionuclides that are anthropogenically formed, they have half-lives of hours or days. And finally, it was globally transported in stratospheric currents and rained out across the globe. And so we can predict fairly accurately based on latitude and rainfall amounts how much cesium-137 was deposited. Here's a graph that shows with the red bars northern hemisphere deposition peaking just before the nuclear test ban treaty in 1963. And the white bars are a little bit more difficultly seen as southern hemisphere. And cesium-137 has been widely used by water erosion researchers to trace sediment movement across the landscape, but many fewer studies have actually looked at it with wind erosion. Adrian Chappell has used it in England and in Africa to take a look at soil redistribution. Richard Harper did a little bit of work with it in New Zealand. Well, the High Plains of Texas is a zone of considerable dust provenance, and Big Spring, Texas is located at the southern end of it. We are a farming region with fragile sandy soils with less than 0.5% organic matter and frequent high-velocity winds during the fallow periods of the winter and the spring. The USDA ARS Research Station has a series of fields right next to each other that we have a very detailed history of erosion and deposition. The infield, we have an area that was in native grassland throughout the entire history of the farm. We have an area that was broken out in 1985 by Ted Zobeck to study the effects of returning CRP land into cultivation after it had been in CRP for a while. So that's the cultivated since 1985 area. We have an area that's been cultivated throughout the history of the station, beginning in 1915 at the northern end, that has been kept in relatively protected status from wind erosion. But just south of that, we have a 100-meter diameter circle that from the years of 1985-9 until 1997 was kept in a smooth, bare situation to encourage wind erosion so it could be measured and processed as studied. And in order to protect the fields around the circle, an area was listed around the circle to capture the sand that would be moving in saltation very near the surface. Finally, at the very southern end of the farm, we see an Arizona cypress windbreak. And I have no idea when this was planted, except to say that before the pulses of the radionuclides, these trees were quite large. As I see aerial photographs in 1957, the trees were mature. So we sampled and analyzed surface soils in each of these different management areas, and in the area cultivated since 1915, we took surface soil samples and sieved them into different particle sizes. And we also collected soils during wind storms at different heights above the surface, at 5 centimeters, 10, 20, 50, and 1 meter above the surface. And again, I'll show you a graph of how the particles sort with height above the ground. The soil sampling, we collected 18 cores, 60 centimeters in length from each of the areas to take a look at the soil profiles. We cut those at 5, 10, 15, 30, and 45 centimeters and made composite samples that would weigh in excess of a kilogram each for the gamma ray spectrometry that Jerry did for us out in Beltsville. Then we converted these into activity per area basis by multiplying by the depth and the bulk density of the cores as were measured from collection. And then we also ran simulations using a suite of models developed by Walling and Hugh in 2001 and published by the IAEA, I keep getting those, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And we used the known cultivation parameters of the area and the deposition and erosion histories as were measured as input parameters. Well, the activities of the sieve surface soil samples agreed pretty darn well with those that were captured in the BS&E samplers. And if you take a look, the activity of about 2 to 3 becquerels per kilogram in the 75 to 53 to 75 micron range for the sieve soils agrees pretty well with that collected at the 0.5 meter and the 1 meter level above the soil surface in a windstorm. Now let's take a look at the soil profiles. And the reference site, the black circles on both graphs there, is what we judge everything by. This is ideally an area in which no erosion or deposition has occurred. So we're going to compare the inventories both with respect to the shape of the curves as well as total amounts in the models. And if we take a look at the reference site, we can see that it's fairly high up near the surface, a little bit below the surface due to a little bit of transport and some alluviation of deposited fine materials. We get a little bit higher pulse. This is known as the relaxation depth, and then very rapidly goes to zero. The two cultivated sites both show mixing due to tillage, but they also drop very quickly to zero at 30 centimeters. And finally, the the massively eroded site where we lost 10 centimeters in the period of accelerated erosion, you can see drops to zero at a much shallower depth. In the depositional areas, we again see the reference site, the cultivated sites thrown in there for comparison, but the infill deposition where a foot of sand was deposited over that time period, we see that the original inventory was buried at depth, and that shows up as the inverted triangle down there between 30 and 45 centimeters. And more interestingly, the windbreak area, the hollow triangles there, shows the highest activity at all near the surface as the finer particles were filtered by the tree canopy. Whoops, wrong way. So we also found a very good agreement between the model and the measured activity for the reference site. And the other areas agreed very well with model results too if we used 1.18 for a particle size correction factor. And here's a table showing just how well some of those areas agreed. We used the area cultivated since 1985 as the training for the model, and the rest of them, you can see we entered the same parameters and we got excellent agreement. So cesium-137 is a very useful tracer. Models to develop soil erosion for water are also applicable to wind erosion if the right correction factor is used. And the particle size correction factor, at least for our sandy loam soil, is about 1.18. Now, unfortunately, cesium-137 has got a half-life of 30.2 years, so only about 30% of the original inventory is left, even in non-eroded soils. So that's exacerbated by local sources of contamination, such as Chernobyl, that spit a bunch of cesium out and was deposited locally in the area in Europe. So we really need to be looking into the next century and millennium for another soil tracer. So as we look at some of the other anthropogenic isotopes, a lot of them are biologically active, so they're out of the question immediately. So that led us to plutonium-239 and 240. They're biologically inactive. They have very long half-lives of, in the case of plutonium-239, over 24,000 years, and for plutonium-240, 6,500 years. So they're not going to change in our lifetime, not going to change much in the next century. Finally, using the two in a ratio, we know the stratospheric fallout ratio is about 0.18. So when we take a look at the total inventories, we can take a look at the ratios and have some verification that this is fallout plutonium, not from a local contamination source. We dry ash 25 gram splits of the samples that were analyzed for the cesium. We extracted them with nitric acid and exchanged them onto Teva resins, and then used sodium nitrite to elute them into an aliquot to be analyzed by ICP-MS. Here's the elution process underway. If you take a look at these graphs, they look almost identical to what we saw in cesium, except for the scale. There is a difference in the activities between cesium and plutonium in the soils, but the patterns are almost identical. If we take a look at the soil profiles and compare them, we get a very good agreement here with an R-square of 0.97 and a pretty good equation line. And we take a look at how it sorts out on particle sizes, again, very, very identical to how cesium works. So, the conclusions for the plutonium study is that the data agree very well with the cesium results for reference eroded and depositional soils. It shows a great deal of promise for an erosion tracer into the next century and beyond. But we still need a lot of further work to convince the rest of the scientific community. Several years ago, they tried to make it work in Europe on some more organic soils and found movement on organic matter to be a real problem. But where wind erosion is concerned, we generally have very low organic matter, so it really doesn't cause a problem. So with that, I'll raise it to questions, and it doesn't look like I got a whole lot of time for questions.
No, not too much.